You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Inside Vegas is presented by MyBookie.ag. MyBookie.ag is the official online sportsbook of the Inside Vegas podcast, as well as the Sports Gambling Podcast Network. Use promo code SGP50 to receive a 50% deposit bonus today. Inside Vegas is also brought to you by Oddshark. Oddshark has the latest betting trends available nowhere else, as well as betting picks from their supercomputer. Check out all of their quality content and betting trends at oddshark.com. Welcome into another episode of the Inside Vegas podcast. I apologize for a little bit of a late release this week. Some things going on. If you know anything about moving, it's the absolute worst. But nevertheless, we are here now. And we're continuing this little mini series of niche handicapping and markets that are kind of primed to be explored and exploited. And just kind of talk about, you know, some of the best people in these markets to try to, you know, figure out some other ways to make money other than just joining the general public, betting football, baseball, basketball, in some areas that are kind of only kind of bet amongst professionals. Professional bettors are kind of notorious for betting these markets, including, you know, WNBA and some of these niche stuff that's just not explored by the day-to-day casual bettor, mostly because Vegas doesn't offer a lot of these things, honestly. But with the introduction of kind of offshore, and I'm sure as everyone knows, their local books, these things are kind of all over the place now. So it's another thing that, you know, Vegas doesn't have kind of all the options that offshore does. Vegas is still not hanging team total for baseball or football outside of playoffs and kind of primetime spots. So whether you live in Vegas or you don't, I think it's kind of important to kind of be able to shop around and get the best of the number, of course. But even to get down on some of these areas, you need to have multiple books. It's just kind of how it is in today's sports betting landscape. So we're going to be bringing on the White Whale, one of my absolute favorite people in the world. He was one of the first people that we highlighted on the social media player podcast article that was one of the first ones that was done. He has amassed such a great following, has his own podcast titled The Deep Dive, which is an NFL heavy podcast during that season. And after that, they touch on everything. And one of Whale's best sports among any is tennis. So that's what we're going to be doing today, is looking at the tennis market and all things betting tennis and kind of the Grand Slams and how that differs from day-to-day tennis betting when there's a tournament just about every week or month. Kind of talk about the futures market, the difference between men's and women's markets, and try to get you guys introduced to a market that I think is very ripe to be exploited and kind of get you guys into betting tennis. A lot of stuff is overnight for all you degenerates out there. But other than that, it's a great opportunity to make money. So I hope you enjoy the interview with the White Whale. And now joining me on the Inside Vegas podcast is the one and only White Whale. Can be found on Twitter at Whale Capper. Done a ton of great work in the space. He was one of the first people that we kind of did the social media player profile with on Sports Gambling Podcast. And in all honesty, he's one of the sharpest tennis minds that I know. I mean, there's so many tournaments that go on day in, day out, or week in, week out, rather, not to mention the Grand Slam titles, and he's betting every single one of them nonstop. And so that's kind of why I wanted to bring him on specifically for this kind of mini series introduction into kind of niche markets and things that aren't baseball, basketball, football. But, you know, wanted to get into kind of the weeds of some markets that people have proven to find profitable, but that they're, for whatever reason, there's not a ton of casual fan interest. So without any further ado, how are you, my friend?
I'm well. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk some tennis.
That's
the thing, right? You're one of the only people I know that actually, not only people, but you're one of a few that actually enjoys tennis. So before we break that down, let's just kind of give a little introduction to how you kind of broke into the tennis market and began betting tennis kind of day to day.
Sure. So I've bet tennis slams for as long as I've been a sports bettor. So that goes back probably about 10 years. And, I was a country club kid growing up and played tennis and swam. And so, you know, once I've, you know, got into the betting sport, you know, you're in the middle of the summer and the Wimbledon's on and I'm like, oh, this is great. You roll out of bed, watch Wimbledon all morning. And I was like, man, they could handicap this. I like this. And, so I got into betting tennis that way. Kind of figured my way around, like, okay, money lines are kind of the most common lines you can find. And then there's other markets like handicap on games or sets, or you can bet total over under on games and sets. And so it's kind of explored the marketplace through betting some of the summer slams. I got really serious into sports betting in general, probably about like 3 years ago. And, I was kind of figuring my way around, well, what am I going to do when the NFL is not going on? Cause the NFL is really my passion for sports betting, mm-hmm. you know, is birthed out of the NFL. And you know, there's what, 7-8 months of the season where we don't have anything to bet on when it comes to football. And so I kind of I tried my hand in some soccer. I did not do well at that.
Yeah. Join the club.
College basketball is very, very tough for me for whatever reason. I just can't keep up with all the moving parts. I've started kind of finding my feet in the NBA. I've always done the NBA playoffs pretty well, but this year for the first season, I'm looking at positive units on NBA handicapping. And then I stumbled into tennis and I was like, you know what? Like, I put together a model for the Australian Open. Back in 2016, I want to say, it was my first time modeling tennis. And I was like, man, there is no databases around. Like, there is, like, how do you get database or information or any of this stuff? And it was a struggle because you go to, like, you know, ATP.com, which is ATP is the governing body of the men's side of the tour. And you, like, go to their stats page and, like, they have one stat. It's like most aces ever. And it's like, this isn't helpful. Like, what am I supposed to do with this?
Right.
And so you kind of realize, like, oh, man, like, this is a totally untapped, like, market. Like, there's nothing, you know, big out there. I since have found great databases that are way off the radar. But, you know, I kind of realized at that point, like, you know, if it's this hard to find data to handicap, like, these markets must have lots of vulnerabilities. Like, there must be some ways to really make money doing this. And I looked at the calendar and I was like, you know what? Like, the season starts as NFL is winding down. The kind of the best tournaments of the season are all throughout the summer when there's no NBA. And the season kind of winds down, at least for me, it winds down with the U.S. Open, which is the last slam of the season around Labor Day, which, you know, gives, you know, makes way perfectly for the NFL seasons to start. And I was like, okay, this could work. And so I kind of really put my time and effort back in 2016 into developing a model that I could use to handicap matches on the men's side. I had some great success. You know, I had mixed success in 2016, but I had a couple heaters and I was like, this really has potential. And then 2017, I was like, okay, I sat down in January. I looked at the whole calendar and I was like, okay, I'm going to focus on, you know, one tournament a week all throughout the whole season. So I laid out like 40 tournaments. I was going to handicap them all. And I was like, okay, if I focus on one tournament, I can kind of watch some of the tennis results. You can get a feel for like the player's form and, you know, kind of use your eyeballs to go along with what I had from my numerical model. You know, 2017 just had awesome success. I think I only had like maybe 3 or 4 out of the 25 tournaments I handicapped where I didn't make money. So I was pretty stoked and I was like, this is, and like along the way, like you kind of figure out like, this is degenerate delight, man.
It's a lot, like, of overnight waking cashes, right?
There's a lot of overnight waking cash. There's betting every day. There's a lot of, you know, when it's not overnight, it's in like during the daytime when there's no, you know, US sports live. And so I was like, you know what? I can find, you know, a handful of plays every day. and work my way through these tournaments, kind of learn along the way. And so last season was a tremendous success. This season so far, I'm off to a lovely start thanks to a really strong Australian Open. It's been a ton of fun, and it is the perfect kind of example of a niche market. You know, you find a sport you love and love to handicap, and there's not a lot of whales, pardon the pun, in the marketplace moving lines out of reach where you can find an edge and you can make some money and enjoy the sport even more.
And there's so much to dive into, pardon that pun for you, with your deep dive podcast. But there's so much to get into with what you just said there, and I don't even know really where to start. But the question I always get asked to kind of explain is, you know, my thing has always been UFC, and it's, you know, how can you handicap that? And to me, it's very simple, because styles will always make fights, right? So you can always kind of, you know, that can always be sort of in the back of your mind when you're trying to handicap this. I mean, I love sports and betting on sports that is, you know, somewhat one-on-one, just because I'm somebody that likes to eliminate variance. That's why I take advantage of the first five market or the first inning market, even within baseball, or I bet, you know, more totals than I do or money line stuff in the NFL, just because I like to eliminate variance and try to make life as simple as I can. And tennis is obviously just like that. So is handicapping, you know, each tennis? I mean, I know you said that you started off with kind of a model type algorithm thing, but is there, you know, a film study? Is it more recent form for each player, or how do you kind of go about starting to even handicap, you know, two people hitting a ball back and forth?
Yeah, it's a fair question. And to be completely honest and cards on the table, I just Googled, like, you know, how do you build a tennis model? And like, there was a bunch of people who had kind of gone this way before me, and they were like, okay, well, we'll start with, you know, past results. Like, how good is this tennis player against an average player?
Right.
Right. Like, what does his career statistics tell you? Like, this guy has, you know, is he, you know, winning 80% of his matches, or is he winning 20% of his matches? And you can kind of, you know, just start with just career, like win loss is a great starting point. I like to kind of break out my win loss into time periods. So like, I'm looking not just at their whole career, because you could be, you know, a guy could be at the very tail end of his career, it could be winding down, and you don't want to necessarily assume, like, you know, hey, well, he went, you know, 50-3 back in 2008. Like, you don't want to be counting that very highly in your model, you know. But so basically kind of look at, okay, well, how's he done in the last year? Well, how's he done in the last 2 years? Well, how's he done in his career? And you can kind of give those things separate weights and kind of say, okay, well, this is a reasonable score then for like how good this guy is just against an average player right now, right?
Yep.
And then from there, you got a jumping off point to start to kind of put knobs and dials on there to account for various factors that you think are important. The most obvious starting place for tennis is the surface. Right. Not all tennis matches are played on, you know, like the tennis you may have played growing up as a kid on, like, a, you know, green hard court. You know, every single surface that they play on throughout the course of the tour has different characteristics that you want to account for. And there's kind of these broad categories, like, you know, the French Open is played on clay, and the U.S. Open and the Australian Open are played on hard court. And Wimbledon is played on grass. And so you can kind of then break out players' past performances on each surface and use that to kind of take your score of them to another level for the surface of the match that they're playing on.
Do you handicap, not to cut you off, but do you handicap certain players on each different surface more, or do you kind of look at how, you know, I don't want to say how a ball bounces, because that sounds so rudimentary, but how to word this, but do you, you know, how a tennis ball bounces on clay versus how it bounces on grass or a hard surface? Like, is it more one-on-one how the player performs on each surface, or is it how the surface treats people in general? I guess is how I wanted to word that.
They go hand in hand. Okay. Like, they go hand in hand because, and you can use past performance on a given surface as a good indicator of how well they will do going forward on that surface. But it's
almost 100% because of the things you mentioned. Like, how does the ball bounce off of that surface? Does the surface itself take speed off the ball? And in that case, you know, that plays into, like, clay is the best example. We're about to enter the called in the handicapping circles or tennis circles, I guess, the clay season. We've had a major and a couple of masters on hard court. Once April rolls around, the tour moves to Europe primarily. And we have like a bunch of really high profile clay tournaments all leading up to the French Open. Monte Carlo starts next week. That's a Masters 1000. So that's like worth a ton of money and a ton of points. After that you have tournaments in Barcelona, Madrid, Rome. And then that leads into, there's a couple of smaller ones too, like Munich has a tournament and, I'm forgetting a couple more, but, that leads into, Roland Garros in Paris, at the end of May. And, the players who typically do well on clay, one thing that's kind of interesting, they know like that part of the season is where they're going to like rack up points, mm-hmm. right? They're going to rack up wins. They're going to make their money so that they can survive as a professional tennis player all during that time window. And so they like train themselves physically to peak during that time window. Right. And so,
Know that they perform so well on a specific surface when that type of surface is coming up heavy, that's when they kind of go all in and everything.
That's right. They'll play more tournaments. They'll sandbag other tournaments other times of the year so that they're not like incurring like miles and getting themselves tired. They'll try to and then they'll just kind of try to peak physically and have their game peaking as they get into that time of year, so that they can get as many wins and make as much money and because that's their best chance. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's their best chance for these clay players at least is because they don't necessarily have very strong service game, right? And the clay and the speed of the ball coming off of the clay neutralizes big serves, right? So it kind of brings everybody to a common level. If you don't have a banging serve and you're playing on clay court, you're not necessarily at a disadvantage to a guy who's like 6'10", who can serve the ball, you know, 150 miles an hour. So just kind of that neutralizing factor gives these players a better chance. The ball coming off slower means you can get to a lot more balls too, right? Like it's not as easy to hit a winner on clay, mm-hmm. Just because it's coming off slower. So a guy can run and get to it. That kind of gives an advantage to the smaller players who have better mobility, right? Like they can run around the court, you know, and defend and return, and you have longer rallies. And, you know, some players can handle long rallies. Like they're just physically fit, like to run a marathon, whereas other guys are more like sprinters. And like you get like 10 shots into a rally and they're gassed. And then a smaller guy who's been, you know, who's having no problems can put him away just because, you know, he's too tired to get to, you know, a short ball or to the opposite side of the court. And so it's just the speed of the court kind of controls all of that, right? And it's crazy to the tune of a guy who is the greatest tennis player of all time, Roger Federer, literally will not play clay this year. He did not play clay last year, not because he was hurt, but because he was just like, I don't have the game for this. And I have a limited number of matches left. I'm not going to waste my time playing clay because I just know that I don't have a chance at winning these tournaments, and I'm not going to put those miles on. And so he's basically just kind of put himself on the shelf until grass season rolls around in July or June. And, you know, he's kind of ceded way to Rafa Nadal, who's, you know, the greatest clay court player of all time. And, yeah, so it's kind of fascinating. And I guess the one other thing I'll mention is a lot of it also kind of depends like how you were brought up, right? Like if you were born in like Spain or southern France or other parts of Europe where they play predominantly on clay, like that's your home turf, right? Like right. You feel at home on that surface. You understand how, you know, how to construct points better, how to win rallies and how to, you know, how to win matches. On that surface more so than you would on a hard court or a grass court. And so, you know, all those kind of things play into why a guy is good on clay. And you can tease that out of their records pretty, pretty, even if you don't know tennis, even if you've never heard of, you know, the 30th ranked player in the world, you've never heard his name, you can still kind of tease out who's good on clay if you have a good database and you start kind of building a model, kind of trying to weight that aspect of past results and in turn in determining who's good on and who's going to be good in a certain match.
And you being such an algorithm model guy is one of the things that I've always admired, because to me, I can't use a model or an algorithm because I need to give myself kind of the eye test when I'm watching something, right? I need to, you know, because if the model tells me one thing and I, you know, really feel strongly about something from a subjective standpoint, and, you know, whichever side wins, I'm going to feel awful that I didn't just trust the model or I didn't, you know, kind of go with my gut in any situation. So I think that you have to make it a constant long game, which can be so difficult for people to do, to kind of take their own bias out of it and just kind of run with the model. Is there any, I don't want to say, I mean, have you dealt with, you know, kind of a time where you were like, you know, I don't want to trust the model here, but I have to, or do you kind of go back and forth being, you know, such a model driven handicapper?
Yeah. It's taken me years to kind of get to the place where I know what to do with model result, if that makes sense. The first probably 6-7 years I was sports betting, I was not using a model. I was primarily betting with my gut. I was trying to pick up tips on situational handicapping angles, things like that, because I was like, this is how you win long term. And then out of the blue, I was like, oh, I'm going to try to build a model for the NFL one time. I did it. I backtested it. The results I was looking at were like, this is ridiculous. Like, I figured out.
The you got the holy grail to gambling,
like,
right?
Shit. Yeah. I was like, this is crazy. Like, this is so, I'm never going to lose anymore, ever again, you know? And you crank it forward and you're like, wait a second. My backtested results, I was like 11-4 every week. I just got like a 8-7 this week. Like, what the hell happened? You know? And you don't kind of realize that there are aspects when you're backtesting and stuff like that.
The market
kind of
corrects itself and you're not accounting for that during backtesting.
100%. And you're using data that is influenced by the performances that you're backtesting against. So it's like, yeah, Patriots are 18-0 and you use their metrics from that season and backtest and it tells you to bet the Patriots every time, right?
Of course.
It's like, yeah, duh. Yeah, of course. And so, you know, there are those kind of things kind of you learn the hard way early, like, okay, well, the model itself may give you an edge. One, you don't have to bet every single edge. And two, not all edges are created equal. And three, you know, sometimes you think you have an edge from the model, but you actually don't, because there are other factors you haven't accounted for, like situational factors or injuries or things like that, that aren't baked into the numbers. And you got to make those adjustments yourself. And so I kind of went through the process of like, okay, well, now I have a model. I'm just going to bet it blindly when I have an edge. I'm just going to use Kelly criteria, and I have this numerical edge. And here we go. Let's just, you know, we'll go long game here, and we'll just take our lumps. And I actually did this with tennis, and I was like, okay, well, you know, I'll just kind of spill some of the beans here a little bit. When you run a tennis model, if you're doing it right, you almost certainly are going to be identifying an edge on underdogs, like, all the time, right? Like, for whatever reason, the market is always tilted toward the favorites in tennis. And you run a model and you're like, okay, I need to be betting 7 of the 8 underdogs today. And then
it's because you only have to hit 3 or, you know, 2 or 3 out of
them. You only have to hit 2 or 3. Yeah, right. And, but like, you know, you're betting, you know, +300, +500 underdogs. And like, yeah, you only expect those to hit, you know, 1 out of 4, 1 out of 5 times. And it's like, you know, so you take a lot of lumps. if you're just betting, you know, you're like, I have a 2% edge on these long shots. And, you know, you could go weeks and weeks and weeks where there's just not as many upsets because for whatever reason, there's a lot of factors. I have a lot of theories and situational factors in tennis. You know, because it depends on, you know, how important the match is for certain players and, you know, how much money is at stake and things like that all kind of play into whether or not there'll be an upset. And, you know, if you're just betting the model blindly, you know, you're going to miss a lot of that stuff and you're going to take a lot of lumps. And I definitely went through periods of time where I was flat betting, you know, where I was Kelly betting the model results and just kind of like, wow, this is brutal. Some weeks you were just so in the red, you can't believe it. And other weeks you're doing great, and people, you know, and I and I got unlucky, I think, in a little regard, in that one of the first weeks I was just like, okay, I'm going to do this. It was the Rio Open in 2016 in February. It was right after the Super Bowl, and I was bored, and I had nothing else to bet on. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to blind bet the model. And for whatever reason, like, that was just one of, like, the most, like, upset-filled tournaments of all time. And, like, in the semifinals, like, there was, you know, Pablo Cuevas, this unknown Uruguayan guy, upset Rafa Nadal. And on the other side, this Argentinian grinder, Guido Pella. Paya upset this kind of well-known, clay court guy with 500 wins to his name. And it's just like, you know, I hit these like plus 500s, and I was like, oh my gosh, like, again, like, I got it all figured out. Like, this is so easy. And then like 3 weeks go by and like not a single underdog hits, and I'm just like complete giving it all back. And then some, and I was just like, okay, I gotta come up with a new way to do this. And that's kind of similar to all my kind of stories, I guess, about using numerical models in sports betting, is that part one is build a model and get a baseline result. And like, it's going to be a good starting point. But then part two is like, critically evaluate those results and try to find reasons for and against actually backing those. Because, you know, sometimes there's an edge that's born out of the line is wrong and the public is wrong and your model is telling you you have an edge and that's correct. But other times there's an edge and it's because there's something you don't know that other people know, that the line has moved in the right direction, and you know that edge is going to lead you astray. And so you kind of learn the hard way, more or less, that you can't just blind bet a model. You have to incorporate judgment at some level. And, you know, to your first point about like, okay, you want to kind of, if, you know, you have a gut feeling about something and the model is telling you the other way, like, you do your homework and try to see, okay, well, do I need to, you know, what adjustments do I need to build in here to account for what my feeling in my gut? And like, if you're feeling something in your gut and you make adjustments that are reasonable and your model is still like, this is still not the right side, like, chances are it's not the right side. And you're going to save yourself some money, and the model is going to save you from making a bad bet, you know, on that basis. And then other times, you know, it's, you know, if you make the right adjustments, you could confirm exactly what you're thinking in your gut. And you can, you know, the baseline model might say, you know, bet Portland tonight, and you make the right adjustments for injuries and rest and things like that. And it's like, oh, no, you should be betting Utah. You know, and it's like, okay, well, bet Utah. And then sure enough, that ends up being the right side. Those kind of things happen on the regular using analytic models. And, you know, there's really no absolute right way to use them. But you can definitely get into some tight spots if you're just kind of blindly betting them without kind of incorporating, you know, judgment, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And I'm glad that you brought up a couple more great points that are fantastic segues. And for somebody that, I mean, I have never bet tennis, you know, more than what I would call a degenerate stake or the Grand Slams or, you know, specific kind of have fun if they're overnight and I, you know, don't have anything to stay up and do. But to do this, you know, kind of week in, week out, month in, month out during this season is absolutely awesome. To see someone that can do this and do this not professionally, but just do this so successfully, you know, over the long haul. And, you know, nobody has gotten killed betting, you know, 300-600, 700 favorites more than me. I'm here to tell you that right now, as we've always talked behind the scenes and you've seen it happen. And, you know, it's one of those things where I always feel that when these upset happens, they happen in these, you know, like you've talked about, these 4, 5, 6, 7, you know, in a row in the same tournament. And then when the chalk comes in, and I always seem to find myself on kind of the wrong end of that, no matter what I do. And then I get frustrated and the chalk hits, and it, you know, you would think to yourself, okay, you know, similar to the NCAA tournament, if you parlayed, you know, this year, obviously notwithstanding, but, you know, every number one seed over the past, you know, against the 16 seed, you know, over the past 4 years, you know, maybe you've made even money if you parlayed those four matchups every single year. And you can do that almost, you know, I would say, once a month with the tennis tournaments, and it just doesn't work out the same way. You know, there's so many things that go into it when people retire and this and that. And that's what I wanted to kind of bring up to you is... match and game fixing, because this is one of the biggest black eyes on a sport that I've seen. Yeah. And, you know, of course, when I've bet a minus 400 and a couple of parlays and stuff like that and they lose, that's my first instinct is to say it's a conspiracy and that the world is against me and it wasn't my fault. But is that true? Is it not true? Has there things that you've kind of found out in terms of people, you know, tanking tournaments to get ready for the next one? There's not a lot of money on the line, because each tournament, and based on how prestigious that tournament is, will dictate kind of what the purse is, for lack of a better word, if I kind of understand the tennis, you know, breakdown and payouts correctly. But it's been talked about to, you know, it's a known fact that this is, maybe outside of boxing and, you know, mixed martial arts fights, one of the biggest problems with tennis is match fixing. So have you kind of encountered that, or kind of how do you handle that type of thing?
It's impossible for me to really tell you how common it is, other than to say it absolutely happens. I don't think it's as prevalent as you would get the sense if you follow a certain segment of the gambling community, because they like to blame losses on things like match fixing when it could be all sorts of things. All it just could be randomness. That said, there are certain players who I have on a list who I don't bet, because I suspect that in the past they've fixed matches. And there are certain tournaments that I don't bet, because those are the types of tournaments where the stakes are so low for the good players that they are there to pick up their round one check and get out of there, get out of Dodge. Right now is a great example. There is one going on now. There is an ATP tournament in Marrakech, Morocco, and last year, this wasn't an example of a fix, but people probably thought it was. Last year, the number one seed was Grigor Dimitrov. He's a Bulgarian guy, top 10 player in the world, top 10, not just in ranking, but like actually in skill, and deserves to be top 10 player in the world. He was the class of the field. It wasn't even close. This tournament was worth 250 ranking points if you won outright, which is very small. By comparison, if you win like Indian Wells or Miami, which are just the two biggest non-majors that just got completed here in the United States, you get 1,000 points. So this one, even if you win it all, you get only a quarter of the points that you would get from a bigger tournament like Miami. And the purse itself is probably even less than a quarter of what the purses are for some of the bigger tournaments. So the payday really was not there. And, you know, this guy gets run by a much lesser player.
This was the last time I bet tennis, by the way.
This guy was a minus 500 favorite. I rolled out of bed. I looked at the line. I was like, Jesus Christ, minus 500? Like, this guy is classes better than his opponent. Like, there is no excuse for the line to be this low. Like, something's up. and you think, okay, well, maybe he's like, word is out, he's fixed it or whatever. And, you know, like, all right, well, I'm staying away. And sure enough, he loses. And you look at it and you're like, man, did he fix the match? And then, like, later on, like, that day, it kind of trickles out, like, oh, he made a deal to play an exhibition match in Monte Carlo before the Monte Carlo Open starts. He's going to play that match on Saturday when he would be in the semifinals of the Morocco Open. And so, you know, he's thinking like, I don't really give a fuck. Like, I'm not sticking around long in this tournament anyway. So, you know, whoever beats me, I don't care. And so he just, you know, the writing was on the wall. Like, if the going got tough, he was getting out of Dodge. And sure enough, he drops a set and a tiebreak or whatever. And he's like, all right, I quit. I'm out. And so that kind of attitude and motivational, you know, angle matters a lot when you see top players in these small tournaments. Like, they just don't, they're the likelihood that something weird happens and they give up and head on to their next destination, take their check with them. That kind of stuff happens a lot. And it's almost impossible to kind of find out that stuff beforehand, because usually, you know, something trickle out, like, you know, somebody will find out from, you know, Dimitrov's, social media manager or whatever, like, oh yeah, she bought him a plane ticket to Monte Carlo. Why is he going to Monte Carlo? Oh, he's got an exhibition match lined up that he's going to get paid $100,000 to play on Saturday. Like, okay, that makes sense now. It all adds up. And, you know, those things are impossible to figure out. But thankfully, like,
tennis has a really, really, really strong like social media fandom side to it. And you can kind of just comb a handful of accounts on Twitter and learn a ton about what the players are doing outside of the court. Way more so than you can get out of NFL players, way more than you can get from college basketball. NBA is pretty similar. Like if you're following NBA Twitter, you know a lot about what the players are doing off the court. And tennis Twitter is kind of the same. Like yeah, you can find out a lot of that information.
Inside Vegas is presented by MyBookie.ag. MyBookie.ag is the official online sportsbook of the Inside Vegas podcast, as well as the Sports Gambling Podcast Network. Use promo code SGP50 to receive a 50% deposit bonus today. Inside Vegas is also brought to you by Oddshark. Oddshark has the latest betting trends available, as well as betting picks from their supercomputer. Check out all of their quality content and betting trends at oddshark.com.
This is why we kind of see eye to eye in how we bet tennis and how I bet UFC, because when you bet a sport that is one-on-one, you can get into a person's life very easy. And one the best things to do for UFC handicapping is to go and follow and find these fighters' Instagram pages and see how are they looking, because they're not shy about posting photos with not a lot of clothes on, you know, be it a male or a female. And you know what I mean? That's not to say you're creeping one way or another. That's to see what kind of shape these people are in, what gym they're training at, because people switch gyms all the time within UFC. And so you can gain so much in, you know, I don't even want to call it inside info because it's available, but you just have to be kind of willing to put in the work. So I'm kind of, you know, again, this goes back to, you know, betting a single person versus betting a team and kind of taking out variance. And there's so many parallels when you talk about, you know, kind of home court and what people are good at. And this will, you know, to make a parallel to kind of football, this is betting, you know, a team like the Rams, you know, when they were the greatest show on turf, you know, being, are they on turf or are they not? Atlanta has been, you know, over and over a great example of this, where they're on turf or they're not. And, you know, if they're in Chicago, Chicago Bears are notorious for kind of keeping the grass long and, you know, it's kind of trying to slow things down. The Saints is another example. These dome teams that have to go outside, and there's a reason that they're so much better, is because they're built for their home, you know, stadium. Or be it as it may, you know, whatever the situation may be, they kind of tailor their roster to what, you know, they're going to be playing in 8 games a year. Of course, you know, UFC, the environment is always the same, you know, obviously based on, you know, judging and where an event is being held is different, but the surface is all the same. So that's why, to me, you know, tennis is individual, but it also has a lot of parallels to kind of team sports, and because the surface can be so drastically different from one player to the next. But with that, do you bet, you know, more future stuff and then kind of hedge against yourself or let things ride? Or do you bet kind of more day-to-day matchup stuff, or kind of how do you kind of attack that market in the futures market, just kind of shifting the gear towards the market side of tennis rather than, you know, the philosophy of how you handicap it?
Yeah, so futures, I really tread lightly on futures unless I'm betting a Grand Slam. Week in, week out, there are future markets that open up for the smaller tournaments, and they are notoriously tough to make money on. The field, and it all comes down to how big the field is. 128 players will be in the field in the French Open. That right there creates kind of certain tiers where you can find value for guys to go a certain distance into the tournament. So you can do more than just, okay, well, I think this guy's going to win, I'm going to bet that, and then I'm done, right? Like, it's more like the NCAA tournament, right, where you have 68 teams to choose from, and you can kind of... as long as they make it to a certain round, you know you're going to be able to extract some value out of that play, right? It's kind of, that's the same kind of philosophy you can take into a major or a slam. And with the smaller tournaments, with the smaller fields, they basically, like, if you're betting a future on a guy, like, they got to win or else, you know, that's a loss. Right. That's a loss unit. There are a handful of exceptions. They stick out like a sore thumb, right? Like last year on the clay swing, Rafa Nadal was going for his 10th ever title at Monte Carlo, his 10th ever title at Barcelona, his 5th ever title at Madrid, and his 10th ever title in the French Open. He was at 9-9-4-9. And he had a whole advertising campaign worked out with Nike for La Decima. He was going to win his 10th French Open. Like, you watched him play two matches at Monte Carlo, and you're like, oh my God, he is going to run everyone off the surface for all of these tournaments. And the odds never even really reflected it, even into French Open and Roland Garros, where you could get plus money odds for him starting out the tournament. And lo and behold, he walks into Roland Garros and he wins his 10th French Open title without dropping a set. So that was like a stress-free future to have in your pocket. Another good example, last year I hit a great winner on Alexander Zverev, Sasha Zverev, winning the Munich Open. He was in Germany. He was kind of, he had proven himself earlier in the season that he could, you know, he could win titles. And, you know, he was looking good on clay. And you think, you know, you see it all on paper, like, oh, wow, he's like the best player in this tournament. Oh, he's in his home country. Oh, he's trying to make a name for himself in the, on tour and collect titles.
Right.
Oh, he's 8-1 to win this. Like, that's crazy. Like, holy, you know, like, it's an easy swing. Like, you know, you just know that he's going to, you know, he's when, you know, and you can kind of, at least my week of handicapping a tournament starts with kind of looking at the field, looking at the draw, and trying to put players in different categories. And Munich was a great example last year where you looked at the draw and you were like, oh man, Zverev thinks he's here to win this. And he's, you know, his mindset coming into this tournament is, I'm going to win this tournament. And when that's your mindset, you tend to try to either get your matches, your early in the week matches done without, you know, firing all your bullets, and you want to kind of build into your week and get stronger and stronger as you get to each level. So you can kind of, you know, have the mental edge over your opponents, because they're like, holy shit, did you see what he did to this guy last week? Oh, he's peaking, he's rising. Oh, he's going to win this tournament. And you can kind of put players into those categories as you start handicapping a tournament in the week. And, you know, and if you do that and you have a couple guys that you have circled in kind of category one, like, these guys are here to win this title.
Right.
And you look at their prices and they're in the 10-1 range, like, by all means, put a future down on them. And so that's kind of the two approaches I use. Either I'm trying to extract value and make the slams more fun, or I literally see something that is just like a giant shiny silver dollar on the ground, you know, that you have to pick up because it's just like, this is the perfect situation. So,
yep. Yeah, so the longer you go in each tournament betting, or for each tennis player, is kind of the more, you know, quote unquote tennis ranking points that somebody gets. So if somebody is up and coming, you know, they would obviously be fine with, you know, making it two or three rounds, whatever, because they're going to kind of build their ranking and stuff like that.
Exactly.
So how does that, yeah. So how does that kind of, you know, I don't want to say how does that, cause you kind of answered it, but does that kind of play into, you know, what someone's expectation is into a tournament and know when to, you know, kind of hop off, knowing that they're satisfied with kind of how they've increased their ranking and stuff like that kind of day to day?
Absolutely. 100%. Yeah. There are, I mentioned the different categories of guys going into a tournament. I like to categorize a handful of like young up and comers who have favorable draws where they can win a couple of early round matches, you know, and you and those guys, you know, that they woke up or they got the draw, they looked at it and they were like, ooh, I can win a couple rounds here. I'm going to, you know, get 100 points, put them in my pocket, move my ranking up to where I don't have to play qualifiers, you know, mm-hmm. next week. Like that's a huge thing. Cause what's funny is on the ATP tour, if you are ranked between like, I'll say 50 and 100, right? You're one of the 100 best tennis players in the world at that time, but it is still really tough. Maybe you don't have a very lucrative sponsorship. You probably have to pay for a lot of your own travel, a lot of your own flights. You don't have like a huge team around
you.
Wow,
I had no idea. So if ATP invites you to a tournament and you're not, you know, the upper echelon, you have to pay yourself to actually physically fly there or go there.
Oh, yeah.
Tournaments are all
like,
wow.
Okay. Oh, yeah. You're flying yourself there. You're paying for your hotel. You're paying for your coach. If you can afford a coach, you're paying for your, you know, your physical therapist to come with you and your social media person, whatever. You know, your team is your family, all of those people are coming with you at your own expense. And there is a specific threshold where if you aren't ranked high enough and you want to play in just kind of a pretty good tournament, like
you might not be ranked high enough to get in without qualifying, which means you have to win matches to get in to get a paycheck, period. Because if you only play qualifying and you don't qualify for the main draw, you get nothing. You get $0 and you get no points and you get no money. And so getting, you know, so you'll see guys who, you know, come in and, you know, like a match will mean a more to them because they are on that bubble and they have looked down their schedule and they're like, I entered all, you know, five tournaments this summer and I'm in the qualifying list for all of these tournaments because my ranking points aren't high enough. Like if I can eke out a couple wins here, bump my ranking point up 100 points, I'm going to get in to these. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get a paycheck, you know, right. Like I can afford to fly to, you know, Shanghai and St. Petersburg this fall. Right. Like they're literally like, okay, the rest of my calendar will be made if I can just like scratch out a couple points, you know, here and there. And there, you know, you got to categorize guys that way and kind of understand their motivations before a tournament starts, I find. And it goes the other way too, where if you are ranked high enough to be in qualifying, or, you know, to avoid qualifying, you have to, and like, let's say you played in Miami last year and you made it to the quarterfinals. It was a huge surprise run and you got, you know, 250 ranking points out of it or whatever the 125 ranking points you got for making a surprise quarterfinal in Miami. Miami rolls around and you got to, you know, get into all these tournaments throughout the course of the year because of those points and you got a bunch of money. And now Miami rolls back around. If you didn't like do well throughout the year and those points are coming due, like if you don't go back to the quarterfinals, you lose those points, you drop in ranking and all of a sudden you're back in the qualifying game. Like that's miserable. Right. And there's a whole second tier of tournaments called Challenger, which is below ATP. And you know, guys have to make decisions like, okay, if I'm on the bubble, am I trying to go to qualify for these tournaments to get, you know, ATP ranking points to get paychecks, or am I better off going to these challenger level tournaments to try to, you know, get points that way? The paychecks are a lot lower and, you know, the competition is not as hard. And so, you know, it makes it really tough on guys as they're going into the week, like, oh man, I made the semifinals by surprise here in this, you know, 500 level tournament last year. Like I better defend those points or I'm screwed. I'm going to challenger level or I'm going to go into qualifying and I'm going to be shit out of luck. And so, you know, there's ways to categorize guys like that as you go into the tournament. And I always kind of look at the draw, see who's positioned well in terms of they've gotten matched up against players they can beat. Or players that they're of about equal strength to, and then look at last year's and just see who performed well at that venue, because it gives you an indication of two things. One, they understand the venue well, the conditions there happen to work out for them, whether it be the court speed, whether it be like the altitude or the humidity, or like, you know, it's at sea level, or there's, you know, the air is drier, like all those things kind of play into, you know, how guys play well at certain venues. And you can tease that out of just looking at past year's results. And if there's an added component of, well, this guy plays well at this venue, and oh, by the way, he's here trying to defend a great run he had last year. You know, those types of motivational factors absolutely play into guys you want to look to back in the week. And, you know, it's in the back of your mind as you kind of run a model, like you put this stuff in there numerically just because it needs to be accounted for when you're calculating. But then beyond that, you look at the results of the model and you use those kind of angles to help strengthen your position. And, okay, I'm definitely taking this guy on the money line versus, you know, okay, this underdog, he's here defending points. He needs this win to stay off challenger. You know, that could be the kind of thing that tips me from, I'm going to back the over in this match because I think he's going to give it everything he's got and he's probably going to come up short, to, okay, I'm going to back the money line in this match because this guy is going to come out here and fire everything he's got. Right?
Exactly.
He's going to go balls to the wall.
And that's what, yeah, I wanted to ask, so, you is, do, yeah, you play more spread, or do you go for the whole thing in these plus 400 or 500 money lines? Because when we talk about this market, you know, one thing that UFC, again, and not to keep making this parallel to UFC, but it's kind of the only other one-on-one sport that you can bet. And outside of a decision handicap, which very, very, very few books offer, I think Five Dimes is maybe the only book that offers a points handicap. And again, that's only if it goes to decision. Sometimes it's not an action bet. If it doesn't go to decision, your bet will lose. There's no really handicap to get in there. But tennis as a one-on-one bet, you can, you know, handicap it and give that underdog, you know, plus however many, you know, sets or whatever. Do you kind of look to do pack underdogs in that situation, or kind of go to the over number of sets played or games played, or kind of instead of, you know, backing a plus 600 underdog that you actually do think is live but maybe not live enough to win it, is that a type of market that could be kind of exploited and explored for maybe someone who's not ready or doesn't have the bankroll to, you know, bet a $300-$400 or plus $300-$400 underdog, you know, week in and week out, knowing that they're going to take some up and down and take their lifts, yeah. You know?
Yeah. No, that even I would say I've evolved to the place where even I'm not interested in really going for the big payday underdogs anymore. I'm satisfied taking the handicap or the over, I kind of approach my decision making systematically. Like I said, for whatever reason, the markets are what they are in tennis. The model is what it is. Maybe I have a bias model. I don't know. It's possible. But there always pops value on the underdog, right? Mm-hmm. And not always. Like sometimes I see value on the favorite, especially if it's like, you know, in slams in particular, like when it goes, all of these kind of in-season tour events are best of three for the men. When mm-hmm. the slams scrolled around, it's best of five. And it's much, much, much more difficult to get an outright underdog winner in best of five than it is best of three. Just because, you know, you're taking some of the randomness out of it. You only got to win two sets. Like a lot of times in slams, underdog could win the first two sets and then lose the next three to the favorite. Like that happens all the time.
Is that make live betting a market that is much more profitable in tennis than any other sport?
For sure. There are people who are making their living live trading tennis. They are very good at it. It's not a market that I'm ever going to get involved in because I don't go to the trouble of pulling together the database you need to be good at that. Mm-hmm. But there are people who are extremely good at that, and that's like their profession for sure.
Trading tennis.
But trading tennis, 100%, yes. And for me, though, I'm almost exclusively betting pre-match. I try to put together a card that has an odd number of plays because that's just like a weird OCD thing, I guess. So I'm looking like for three or five or seven plays for the day in a given tournament. And I'm looking at I crank out my model. I look at my results and I'm like, okay, well, which of these underdogs or which of these, you know, which are their favorites? I look at any given match and I'm like, okay, is there value on the underdog based on my model? Yes, there is. Okay. What is the likelihood of this guy actually pulling this off? Right? Like does he have past head-to-head success against this guy? That's a huge factor in tennis. Like if a guy has beaten a guy before, he knows something about a specific way to attack him. It always doesn't always come through that you beat a guy over and over and over again. Sometimes it does. But if he has a past head-to-head win and he's an underdog, that's a thing I love to know and love to have that in my back pocket. If I'm looking at him, I'm like, okay, well, this guy is, you know, he's going to give it everything he's got. He's going to probably get close. He may win a set. He may, you know, really push this to, you know, a tiebreaker or two. Like, okay, I think he's going to get close, but I don't think he's going to get there. Rather than back him on the money line, I'm going to take the over, because in my opinion, at least an overplay on games played.
Can you just explain the over the over under for anyone that's very new to betting tennis?
Sure, you can bet over sets or over games. I almost always bet over games, and that's just because the book I use offers the best lines on over games. And so basically you're saying how many games will be played? One set, you win a set when you win six games by at least two, right? So you can win 6-0, 6-1, 6-2, 6-3, 6-4. If it's 6-5, you can't win. You have to win a seventh game, 7-5. Or it goes 6-6 to a tiebreak and you win 7-6, mm-hmm. right? And your average set is usually about 6-4, right? So there's about 10 games per set is kind of a good rule of thumb. unless it's, and so if you're backing an over, you're basically saying, okay, this guy's going to keep it close. He's going to take this first set to 7-6 and then second set to 6-4. And there's going to be 23 games and the over unders at 22. I think that we have a game edge here. I'm going to back the over. I don't think my guy can win a set, or I don't think he's going to win in straight sets. I think he's going to lose, but it's going to be close. An over is a good look there.
Right.
The handicap, if I look at the game and I'm like, okay, I like this guy's chances a lot, but I don't want to back him on the money line, and the over is a good look, I'll think about it in terms of, okay, well, what if he wins the first set, right? Like, what if he's comes out like a shot out of a cannon? He just like works this other guy 6-3 or 6-2 in the first set. Is the other guy have a history of packing it in, right? And if the other guy has a history of packing it in, then rather than back the over, I'm going to look for the handicap, because then I'm like, okay, that way you don't take a loss if your underdog, who you've identified with value, wins in straight sets.
Right.
Because there's maybe no worse feeling in tennis than you're like, this guy's going to win. He's got a chance. I don't have the guts to back him on the money line, so I'm going to take the over. And then sure enough, he comes out and just blows doors off the favorite. And you're
right.
Like, great. I took a loss when I had the exactly the right read on the match. Great. You know, and so I kind of try to protect myself that way, and I'll look for like, okay, well, is this, you know, is there a chance that the favorite, if he loses the first set, is going to pack it in? If I think that there is a chance of that, then I'll back the handicap instead of taking the over. And then in certain cases where you're like, okay, I feel really good about this underdog, not only is this a great situation for him, great surface, great head-to-head past results, or like the other guy is just ripe to be faded or whatever, then I'll back him on the money line. And I just try to, you know, do whatever I can to kind of construct a card that covers different angles of attack on a given match, so that if my read is like way off, like I expected the conditions to be slow and wet and they were actually dry and fast, I don't just get worked on the whole card.
Right. So the general rule of thumb between or amongst professionals is, based on 100% of your bet, it's 70 to 80% spread, and then that 10 to 20, maybe 5% on the money line. Do you subscribe to that too when you feel you have a live dog, or do you go more money line heavy and then back the handicap, or how do you kind of differentiate that between your two bets?
I'd say I'm probably one quarter into backing the underdogs outright,
mm-hmm.
About a half into backing overs when I see value in the underdog, but I don't think he wins outright.
Yep.
And then about a quarter in looking for plus games and I didn't mention even like sometimes you go through your whole exercise on a given match and you're like, there's no way this underdog is winning. Like there's too much stacked against him. Like this is too powerful an opponent on too good a surface. And there's not enough value on the underdog. So at that point, I'm happy kind of constructing parlays with favorites. And that probably makes up the last quarter with, you know, some handicap plays in there too.
Right, exactly. So I'm glad you touched on this. I hate to liken this to the NCAA tournament in that it happens, you know, once a month like that. But it's interesting that, you know, this would be, you know, Loyola playing these teams every single month, you know, if you kind of break that down to a person versus person instead of a whole program or team or any, you know, any tournament situation. It's, you know, UFC or boxing, or there's no tournaments. It's always just one person against one person. And so for a sport to be kind of so tournament driven is very interesting, because you get those specific head to head matchups over and over again. And of course, you know, there's that kind of parallel to the NFL with being in your division, and you can kind of look at the regular season somewhat of a tournament, layout, being that they always play, you know, their division for half the games. But do you see, I want to transition this into kind of going away from the day-to-day tournaments, the small time stuff, into the majors. And you touched on the fact that these have notoriously been kind of chalk driven, or that the cream kind of rises to the top, being as how they're their biggest paydays, they're the biggest kind of qualifying ranking points that are up for grabs. especially. And that's, you know, again, the NCAA tournament happens once a year. And, you know, of course, there's these great stories. And that's what we were talking about, of these people kind of, you know, getting, you know, I mean, there's nobody that said Loyola had a bad tournament because they made it to the Final Four. I mean, that's a story in and of itself. And so with it being kind of chalk heavier during these majors that are for a year, or the Grand Slam kind of tournaments, are there, do you look to kind of back chalk heavier? And I know you said that your model will kind of always point you towards underdogs, but how do you kind of deal with that, knowing that these are kind of, this is the best of the best playing on the grandest stage of each event, you know?
Oh, for sure. My general thought on slams is very, very similar to the NCAA tournament. You've drawn a very good parallel there without even betting a lot of tennis. I think you kind of have a kind of, I don't know. And you know, this goes for anyone who's listened to this podcast who may be interested, like, oh, I'm going to give this a shot. It sounds fun. The parallels are there with a lot of other sports. UFC, great example, because it's mano a mano. Tournament is a great example because the kind of the energy and the environment and the kind of the factors that make for an upset are all there. And when it comes to a slam for tennis, when you generally see outright upsets, they're early. They're in rounds one and two. And they're in rounds one and two because a lot of times the underdog doesn't have anything to lose. A lot of times the favorite is not intending to pull out his best game on round one, right? They want to kind of ease into it, right? They don't want to, like, you know, put all their cards on the table for their future opponents to see what they have, you know, in their arsenal in round one. And then, oh, lo and behold, they're down 2-1 to some guy they didn't even expect was going to be, you know, a threat. And, you know, they're fighting for their life in the tournament. Oh, they got knocked out because the underdog got the momentum in the fourth set, which is all, you know, or they won a tie break because, you know, there's lots of coin flippy stuff about tennis. You know, when you see upsets in slams, they're usually in the earlier rounds. And then you get to the later rounds and all of a sudden it's like the usual suspects kind of are all showing up. Right. Yeah. And
that's how the NCAA tournament is. You know, you have Loyola, but at the end of the day, it's always a Villanova. It's always a Kansas. Yep. It's always a Duke that the cream rises to the top.
Yeah. And factors that play into that are experience matters a lot in best of five tennis. If you're not playing best of five all the time, like, you don't necessarily know what it takes to win that particular match, right? And so, you know, you can be the better player on that day and still not win because you didn't realize, like, you needed to like lower your level a little bit in the second set after you won the first to kind of save a little gas for sets three and four, right? Like, those kind of things you learn over time as you play best of five and play at the highest level. And then when they throw you from the outer courts where there's like a handful of people watching onto the main stage, the nerves are just bananas. And you can be playing the best tennis of your life, and then you wake up one day and, like, all of the freaking, you know, Serbian media is in your face asking you questions about your performance. And you're like, what is going on? And you walk out and there's 100 TV cameras and 15,000 people watching you play. And you're like, you don't perform as well. Like, that type of stuff happens on the regular. And so you get to rounds, you know, four or five, you know, round four, quarterfinals, semifinals, and you see much, many, many fewer upsets. That doesn't mean that there's not opportunities to make money and bet, you know, bet with the same kind of philosophy that you would use otherwise. You know, over still hit. You can, you know, a lot of times in those sort of those sort of matches, they'll be, you know, they'll be, the favorites will be really juicy, and even money line parlays, you know, still might be tough to swallow in terms of how much juice you're laying. But
don't talk to me about money line parlays or favorites in tennis, buddy.
Yeah. And, but you can still, you know, you can find, okay, well, this underdog, you know, he's got the chops. He's been in this stage before. He's not going to lose his cool. He can win a set.
Yep.
Right. And maybe you're back over 3.5 sets, basically just like you're backing on the underdog not to get, blank,
it's so funny, right? To me, because path to victory is such a huge thing when it's one-on-one, you know, when it's one person versus one person, sure. Path to victory is kind of everything. And so it's fascinating to me that tennis, the path to victory for an underdog is always the over, and not even to the fact that they're going to win, you know, just come out and dominate in straight sets. But if an underdog is going to hang around and make himself a, you know, a live underdog, it's going to go over. So to me, that's kind of fascinating, in that the market is kind of cut and dry as to the path to victory for a an underdog. Do you find that, you know, again, it's so different because, again, I'm so used to handicapping UFC, in that when a path to victory, it could be he's a fantastic submission artist, which could lend itself to an under, or, you know, he's super durable, but he has no chin, which could lend himself, or, you know, I'm sorry, he's super durable, has a great chin, but he can't defend a submission. So the under is still live there. So to me, it's fascinating that for every single underdog in tennis, as long as they make it kind of an event or make it a match, it's going to go over. That's absolutely kind of... I think that that's right for the exploiting, for lack of a better term.
I agree. Yeah, 100%. And I mean, when you bet an over and you're watching live, the best feeling in the world is the underdog winning a very tight first set, because then you're like, this puppy is going the distance, right? If you know you're getting three sets, that thing's going over. And if it's a tight, you know, if the underdog wins a tight first set, And it's an underdog that has kind of experience and has had upsets in the past, then you know that they're kind of going to do what they can to save it up a little in the second set. And they're going to concede the second set, knowing that they'll have the upper hand in the third set when they're feeling a little fresher and they're, you know, they've saved a little bit of their arsenal for when the going gets tough. And so, you know, you're watching, you know, the two best feelings when you're holding an over are, if it gets to a tiebreak in the first set, you're like, all right, I already got 13 games home. Like, this thing's in great shape. It's an even match, and the chances are you're going to get, you know, another long second set. Even if the favorite wins, you're feeling pretty good about that. Yeah. And then if the underdog can win a tight first set, then you're feeling even better, because you're like, this thing's going three. Put this thing to bed. So that's funny.
Absolutely, man. It's crazy. So I think we've kind of hit on everything, but one thing I do want to kind of touch on is the fact that we've only talked about ATP and girls. We haven't even touched on women's. Sure. And is that just because that's kind of where your model lends itself? Or is that just kind of where you find value, or is the women's sets or women's tournaments and women's games completely different, much in the way that, you know, one-on-one boxing, women's or kickboxing or MMA or anything that is one-on-one, women is a completely different handicap than men?
Two factors. Actually, I could probably talk about this for a while. But the first and most simple one is I do like to see it with my eyes to know, like, the level of player's form, right? Like, I don't need to see the whole match necessarily, but I just need to see kind of key points in the match and kind of gauge, like, in round, because, like, it's you're planning on betting a tournament, you're going to bet it 7 days. Right. And if you start watching on Monday, like, you're going to get a feel, you need to get a feel for what the conditions are like. You need to get a feel for how the certain players are playing. And, like, if you have a handful of players that you think are, you know, are threats to win, you want to see them play round one and two. Right. And so I like to see it with my eyes. And there is a really, really, really useful tool for handicapping on the men's side. The ATP Tour has a product called Tennis TV. That's like, and this is not an ad for them, I'm not affiliated with Tennis TV, but it's like a $99 a year subscription, and you can watch, replay, fast forward, jump around to
like
every match
all 22 for NFL.
Exactly. It's you nailed it. Exactly. It's like all 22 for NFL. That product exists for the men. It makes it much easier to put your eyes on what's going on the men's side. And when I started doing this, like, daily, that product didn't exist for the women. And so it was an easy call. Like, I can't see enough of the women's matches to really gauge, you know, their form. So forget about it. I'm just going to not even going to bother. Separately from that, when I have tried to kind of dip my toe in the water for the women, and again, kind of going by the eye test thing, there's lots and lots of women's tennis players in, like, the 30 to 100 range that I've never seen play. Right. If they haven't made it to, like, the middle later rounds of a Grand Slam, I have no idea what their game is like, or how, you know, how, if they're peaking, if they're fading, or, you know, if they're, you know, where they are in their careers. I just don't know. And so that makes it extremely tough to cap
regularly in the early rounds, especially. And so I just avoid women's tennis in the slams, even in the early rounds, just because I don't know enough about the players to kind of use judgment beyond whatever the model would tell me. And then the third factor is it feels more random in general. And I think this is, I have probably some, I'm speculating a lot here, but the women's, there's slightly less consistency for whatever reason.
Yep.
Be it the kind of the demands of the tour and like whether it's tougher to go out and repeatedly, you know, make deep runs in tournaments. Like there's much more of kind of a rotation, you know, among the top tier women, where, you know, this woman is peaking in this tournament, this one and this one, this one and this one, as opposed to on the men's side where you're like, here comes the clay season, Rafa's going to dominate. Now we're on grass, Federer is going to dominate. Okay. Now, you know, so there's kind of, a difference for whatever reason where it's tougher to maintain long-term consistency unless you're Serena Williams, obviously.
Right.
But all that said, the women's product right now is freaking awesome. Like they have so many like top tier talent, and like I would say of the, you know, when the Australian Open happened in January, like if you told me to rank like the top 10 matches I saw, like 8 or 9 of them were women's matches. Like they were just, it was just a better product. And like part of that is like, okay, Fed is still dominating. Like we saw this last year, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, beyond that, you know, there was just the level of competition and the fact that you had like this whole crop of women who were all peaking. They're all in like the right age range that any one of them could win. A bunch of them were trying to go for their first slams. It just made it absolutely fascinating to watch and watch it play out. And, you know, I have high hopes for, you know, the Women's French Open looks like it's going to be just as good. Wimbledon could be just as good. And now you throw Serena back into the mix as she gets back in shape. But, you know, the women's product is in extremely good hands right now. And it's, if anything, it's more entertaining than the men's side where you have like a handful of players who you think legitimately have a chance to win any slam.
And so, yeah, when we talk about one-on-one sports, I mean, the whole point of kind of garnering interest in is being, you know, kind of marketable and kind of putting, you know, being the face of the sport. And obviously the Williams sisters have done that. They've had a monopoly on that in the WTP for God knows how long now. I mean, since I was a little kid. And obviously, I mean, they've slowed down a little bit, but they're still... whether they win or lose, they're always going to be the face of that sport. And I think they always have that going for them. And they'll always be the, you know, the Sharapovas in the household names of the world. But is tennis more driven by, I don't know how do I kind of word this? Within when it's a one-on-one sport, be it boxing or you know, Olympics or anything that you're going to bet one person versus another person, a lot of even what goes into building that line is kind of how marketable they are, and you can kind of fade that public love or that recency bias. Is there kind of new faces that are kind of coming up within, not even just for the women's, but the women's and the men of kind of who can, you know, be the next Federer, be the next Nadal, be the next Williams sisters? You know what I mean? Is tennis kind of...
Yeah.
Looking at itself to kind of take that next step, or is it just kind of they're happy doing what they do because these players have such a long shelf life?
Gosh, man. It on the men's side, I guess, kind of the state of health of the men's tour right now is not great.
Mm-hmm.
Federer and Nadal are getting old. Federer is like, I think turns like 37 this year. I say that as I turned 37 this year as well, but that's another story. I'm not old for the handicapping world, though. I'm young for the handicapping world.
Exactly.
Federer and Nadal are kind of aging out of the sport. We don't expect to see them for many more years. And when their names aren't in the draw, when they're not able to market the sport with them at the top of any given tournament, it's going to have a huge financial impact on how, you know, ticket sales, TV sales, things like that. There are people who are only in the sport because they are fans of those players. Djokovic and Murray, who were the other half of the big four of the last generation. Those guys look hurt / injured to the tune of it's unlikely we see them play a top level tennis again.
Mm-hmm.
So where do we go now? The guys that were in the generation below them were like
mentally abused by them. if you can get, I don't know if that makes sense, but like they like just Hayes got beaten situation? By these guys so
oh,
many times.
Oh, okay.
No, just in on the court.
Right,
like,
right. Okay. They just
like
weren't
every
on that
time
level.
There yep. was a big match and it was like, you're the next gen. Come on, take the step, beat Federer. You lost 3-0. You know, like they just have taken so many lumps from the big four that I don't think we're ever going to see much out of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's kind of like this gap where there's not like, you know, there's not like a next tier of guys who are the peak, you know, in their prime, who are going to, you know, wrestle control of the tour away from the old farts. And we saw it last year, Federer and Nadal split them slams. Christ sakes. Right. Federer won the Aussie Open in Wimbledon. He won Wimbledon without dropping a set. Nadal won the French Open without dropping a set. Those accomplishments are ridiculous, let alone the fact that that was Nadal's 10th French Open, and then Federer, who just won the Australian Open, that was his 20th Grand Slam. Like, it's crazy that no one has like knocked them off the pedestal. But here we are. Mm-hmm. And so then there's kind of this gap where the next generation really is underperformed. And so then you have to look to like literally like the up and coming youth, right? Like guys who are in like the 24 to 18 range. And you're like, okay, well, which of you guys is going to emerge then? Because somebody's got to win these tournaments. And like there's a couple of guys who have the talent. There's a couple of guys who have kind of the mental makeup. But it's not obvious because none of them have won slams and none of them have even made particularly deep runs at the slams. And so it's like, if you're not, you know, if you're not winning slams, then you're not the face of tennis. I'm sorry. Right. And so a guy like Sasha Zverev, who I mentioned, who won Munich last year, he took a major step in winning Rome Masters. That was a high profile tournament. People were like, oh my gosh, this kid's coming up. He's going to be the next big thing. He goes into the French Open and gets knocked out the first round. And it's like, oh, great. You know, we're all done. He goes through the summer. He goes to the Canada Masters tournament. It's called the Rogers Cup, and it was in Montreal last year, the Coupe Rogier. He beat Federer in the final. It was a crazy, you know, it was a crazy accomplishment. This kid, Sasha Zverev, you know, 20-year-old kid from Germany beat Federer in the Masters final, and people were like, oh my gosh, he's going to make a run at the U.S. Open. He gets a cherry draw at the U.S. Open. They fitted him up in this Pharrell-designed Adidas kit that was like retro, like 1970s block colors. Like, everyone was like high on this kid. He was the third favorite for the tournament, and I think he got knocked out in the second round. And so I was like, okay, you know, like this guy—is he ever going to make the leap? And you know, so there's
to live up to the hype. It happens
ton.
In any sport when you're trying to push somebody and they fall through. Yeah. I completely understand.
So there's a ton of pressure on that generation right now to do something, and you know, whether we see it in 2018 or not is anyone's guess. But you know,
absolutely,
2019, 2020, I think we'll see them emerge.
I want to kind of wrap this up, and I want to tackle two more questions. One to me is, what is the tennis market like? Because it is not only, I mean, tennis, I don't want to say it's not popular within the United States, because again, as we're talking about niche markets, I think it's one of the more popular. I think that UFC is probably the most popular among the niche markets. I think boxing and boxing purists are kind of right below that. And I think the tennis is maybe the 3-4 right after golf, perhaps amongst casual fans. But is there, because it's different when you talk about kind of where these niche markets kind of limits open and kind of where the market will take them, especially, again, speaking from experience, where so many big favorites lose, you know, time and time again. Is the market, is it very fluid? Is it, you know, again, when you go back to UFC, I mean, a minus 180 can balloon out to minus 400-500 if the right people and the right limits are kind of bet on things. But the limits are kept very low at open because odds makers know this. And there's less than maybe 3 or 4 that will allow more than a $100 bet at open. Is this market kind of unique in any situation? Or how does this market kind of shape itself for every tournament, both in the futures and the kind of matchup and, you know, day-to-day match market?
Sure. I'm going to go out on a limb and say worldwide, tennis is probably the second most bet sport after soccer.
Absolutely.
I meant
within like kind of the gambling community.
Oh, sure. No,
in sportsbooks and stuff like that.
you almost have to totally separate them, because like the market, like we are getting wagged by whatever's going on in Europe, right? Mm-hmm. Like, no, I don't think there's any market makers out. Maybe there's a hand, maybe there's a couple in like Canada and Australia and the US. It's possible. I don't think so, but it's possible that there are a couple market makers who are really moving lines in tennis. Mm-hmm. I think almost everything is happening in Europe. And the first book that opens is called Marathon Sportsbook, and it's a UK book. I don't have any access to it as a US bettor. But I know, we always kind of know to go there to look for what are the opening lines are. And they always have a soft landing open. They put up money line numbers first for any given matchup. They get bet to hell. Like, you see them move massive moves in the first like hour, and then Penny will open theirs up about, you know, 15-30 minutes after Marathon, getting an idea of where the market is going with a little bit of larger limits, right? And then the Penny line kind of governs movement after that, and they take by far and away the most money, I believe, of the tennis books. And everything that we get access to is U.S. bettors from offshores, or if they even put lines up in Vegas for these tournaments, is based off of what's happening in the U.K. Mm-hmm. And in general, like, I'm resigned to the fact that like I'm not beating major line moves in tennis.
Right.
Like, I'm not I don't have an alarm clock set to wake up at 2 a.m. when the UK books, it's like 7 a.m. and they've got lines up for Shanghai, you know, day 3, you know, I just know that I'm not going to be beating these numbers. Mm-hmm. So I don't even try. I just kind of keep an eye on it. And, I would say it's a relatively efficient market in that the closing line often is a good indicator, of the correct line. I'd say line movement is misleading about 25% of the time, mm-hmm. maybe 30% of the time. And there's nothing like what we have with like Sports Insight, where you have bet percentages and fading the public and things like that. That doesn't exist. No one's out there like putting a hype video for, you know, Sharps hammered, you know, Borna Coric over, you know, Zverev in the semifinal of this match. You know, there's not that segment of the betting market doesn't exist as far as I can tell you.
Yep.
And so you're left with like people who do it regularly, people who are really into it, and then people who are like just getting into it for the first time, and or are, you know, tailing somebody that they see posting winners. And in the US, and so it was pretty straightforward, actually. I have a really tight group of kind of tennis handicapper friends that I talk to online pretty regularly. And it was pretty easy for us to find each other because there wasn't right. many people who were doing it so regularly. And you know, we like to bounce off ideas and things like that. And that definitely helps us make sharper bets over the course of a season. Absolutely. I'm sure of that. And you know, that it's not, you know, if somebody gets into it and has a, you know, passion for it, like by all means DM me, but like, it's easy to kind of get into if you decide to do it, I would say. And there's probably a pretty significant opportunity for, you know, US bettors to make a move into this market if they feel like if they have a passion for it, really.
You couldn't have set me up any better, bro. My second question was, if somebody's looking to kind of get into this space and start betting tennis, you know, pretty seriously or recreationally, what kind of, you know, how does somebody get started in the market? You know, again, not that I want 100 people DMing you and getting your advice, but what would you, you know, mm-hmm. tell a mass audience of somebody that wants to get into these niche markets and they, you know, they've always been a fan of tennis, but they've never really bet it? Or, you know, how does one get started in the space again? And, you know, I'm speaking to the fact that if you're a fan of tennis, you're obviously going to have a way greater understanding of it than even somebody like I do, who, again, I watch maybe one or two of the Grand Slam events of the year, and that's kind of it. But what's your advice to somebody that wants to get started in this space of this niche market?
Well, definitely get a Twitter account. and follow a handful of folks. I have a couple of lists on my Twitter, and there's a good tennis list of like mandatory tennis follows that are huge for information and news. And you kind of, you know, you kind of immerse yourself in that for a couple of weeks, and you're going to be like, oh wow, there's a lot of information here. I'm starting to know people's names. You know, because really, I guess if you're getting started, the first thing you're going to want to know is like, who are these players? How, you know, what is their history? Where are they from? You know, just try to develop a couple fandoms, really. Like, okay, I like this guy. He keeps winning for me. Or like this guy, I like to fade this guy. You know, like you really kind of want to develop relationships, I think, with a couple of players to kind of really cement your interest in the sport. And then I would go to tennisabstract.com is the best database in the universe for tennis. They have like such a plethora of data and results and information, head-to-heads, stuff that you would need to judge people's past forms at specific tournaments, past forms overall, past forms on certain surfaces, things like that is all available there. And that is a really great resource. I would download the Flash Score app for your mobile device. Flash Score has up to the second live results for in-match play. Easy to follow along if you're not watching a television, or if you're not streaming. The ATP Radio has an app. Actually, ATP Radio is on TuneIn, and you can listen to matches. Listening to matches, I found, is a really great way to learn a ton. In fact, one of the best tricks, I guess, I've learned about betting slams. If you were listening to the radio regularly, they provide so many more tidbits and details and tips about what's going on with certain players, why they're succeeding, why they're struggling, things like that. You glean so much off of the radio broadcast. That's really useful. I mentioned Tennis TV before is a great way to stream tennis. You can watch. I watched it on my Apple TV. You could watch it on your laptop. Rewind and replay and just look at packaged highlights, things like that is all available there. That's a great subscription. Kind of learn the hard way and, you know, get your feet wet. And, and then the very last piece of advice, maybe the easiest piece of advice, like if you're getting started sports betting in general and you just wanted like outside of like bankroll management or whatever like that, things like advice, like just don't play parlays, right? Like it's just too tough to win. It's just too tough to win long term, especially when you're getting started if you're out there swinging on parlays.
Yep.
With tennis, the golden rule that I kind of live by is don't lay juice on handicaps, on totals, because the difference in price that they offer for 22.5 versus 23 does not match what the actual value in that half point is, or that half game. I don't know if that makes sense, but basically if over 22.5 is -115 and over 23 is -105, take over 23 every freaking time. Don't even think about it. If you can sell half games on the totals and handicaps, you are going to find yourself substantially more successful over the long term betting tennis. And to a degree, if I went back to my 2017 season, I had an amazing season. If I went back and regraded all of those plays based on a standard juice line, I don't think I would have made any money. I probably would have broken even if not been in the negative, to be honest, because that's how much, that's how much it matters when you're high volume betting. You know, I think I played like 700 plays in tennis last year, and my average odds were probably like +125 or +130. So I only had to hit like 40 something percent to make money. And if you kick that up to 52 or 55, like for good luck, you know, you're in deep trouble in tennis, especially because of the amount of upsets we see.
Absolutely, bro. So, well, we did it. So I want you to be able to plug everything you have going on in this space, because it's absolutely amazing what you're doing, kind of the voice that you become. Obviously, you know, you have the podcast, your Twitter, that's been doing amazing, and all your content. So go ahead and plug away where people can find you, man.
Of course. Well, thank you for the opportunity to come on to Inside Vegas. I've been enjoying your podcast and I love your venture as well. So this has been a cool experience. I do a podcast as well. We're up to about 60 episodes. The Deep Dive. We're on iTunes. We're on SoundCloud. We're on Stitcher. And my co-host and I, our passion is football. But when we're not talking NFL handicapping, we're talking about tennis handicapping or the Masters or the NBA playoffs coming up. We're going to do a whole series in the next couple weeks talking the NBA playoffs. We're going to make a lot of money in the NBA playoffs. I'm super excited. So check us out on the Deep Dive podcast or at WhaleCapper on Twitter.com. I'm there too often.
So yeah, join the club. And again, every single thing that you've ever put out there is free. So for for anyone that is, again, trying to get into the space, you know, I always try to bring on the right people on this podcast that do things the right way, whether they charge it or they do not. And everything that you've ever done is completely free. And I can't commend you kind of enough for kind of bringing, doing the right thing. Cause there's different thought processes there, especially with me.
Not doing the wrong thing.
Yeah. Doing it the right way. Seriously. Kind of basing your, you know, social media presence off of giving people free information and free content, brother. So again, thank you for coming on, man. And again, free content and anything you could ever want to know with at WhaleCapper on Twitter. The following is growing, over 12,000 followers. You've done amazing things in the space, buddy. So again, continue with the best of luck in the space and all the continued success in your tennis handicapping.
Well, thank you so much, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime and continuing to listen to Inside Vegas.